demoted Grange with Baroness Elaine Murphy. Baroness Murphy has been a life peer in the House of Lords since 2004. After qualifying as a doctor and then as a psychiatrist, she later became an academic in the National Health Service. She was the first professor of psychiatry of old age in the UK, held at the University of London at Guy's Hospital. Baroness Murphy also has a PhD in social history and has published in the field of 18th and 19th century workhouses, madhouses and local history. Her recent publications include The Moated Grange, A History of South Norfolk Through the Story of One Home, 1300 to 2000. This interview is about her home and the characters she met in its history. Elaine, you started off not in wealthy circumstances, didn't you?
My father had originally trained down the mine at Clifton Colliery. He had an apprenticeship as an electrician, but he was a very cultured and erudite man, surprisingly. And so was my mother. They were both very clever and went to grammar school in Nottingham. So he became eventually deputy chief engineer at Boots when Boots was an enormous enterprise. But I grew up in Beeston, near where Boots was. We always say we were brought up by Boots. You know, Boots ran our lives, really. And it was what I would call a standard lower middle class, upper working class sort of life. Very aspirant parents. They wanted for us what they didn't have. There was no way their families could have afforded to send them to university. So they both worked from the age of 16. And they were very determined that we would take advantage. Of course, we were the 1948 Education Act generation.
Have you got brothers and sisters?
Two brothers. One has recently died, but I have two slightly older brothers, yeah.
So it's quite a big family.
Yeah. There were six of us at home because I grew up with my grandmother in the house as well.
I suspect your parents pushed you to go into something education-wise.
Curiously enough, they didn't make any distinction at all between the three of us. They were just always, and particularly my mother, utterly determined we were going to have as much education as we could stuff into us. So they were worried about me choosing medicine which I chose very early on. I think because we had a woman GP which was very, very unusual in the 50s. I'm pretty sure I was impressed with the fact that she had a position in our household, which she was looked on with great reverence. And, you know, if Dr. Thompson said anything, then it went. And I'm sure that must have influenced me. But my parents were very worried because nobody in our family obviously had ever been to university. Well, my brothers at the time were working their way up to it. There was nobody else who'd ever been in that field. And nobody in my school really had ever gone, you know, the grammar school did not prepare people for medicine on the whole. Quite a number of people were good enough to go into sciences in Oxford and Cambridge, but there was nobody pressing anybody to go into medicine. So they were worried about my ambitions to do that. And my father said to me one day, he said, "Why do you want to be a doctor?" And I said, "I really don't know." And he said, "Is it because, you know, it's one way, and particularly for women, to establish themselves in a respected profession?" And I'm sure that was it. I'm sure that had a lot to do with it. You sort of leapt a social class without any trouble if you got into medicine. I was interested in doing something in the caring professions, but what else is open? You could become a nurse, but that's a bit of a slog. You can become a social worker, which I knew nothing about. And it's only later that I came to really respect what proper trained social workers did. But medicine seemed ideal for what I wanted to do.
Now, you spent your whole life in the health service, haven't you?
Yes, absolutely. So I went to Manchester University. Everybody's very surprised when I say I was rotten at sciences. I was totally supported by two brilliant teachers at my grammar school, one of whom I wrote to him when I became a professor to say, you know, I wouldn't be here if it hadn't been for you. He gave me private lessons in physics without any charge, just said, twice a week we'll meet and I'll get you through this exam. He was just brilliant. I had two teachers like that, one chemistry and one in physics, got me through my A-levels. So they helped me get through. I mean, whether people would do it these days for people at grammar school, I don't know. But I was very, very lucky. And so I got into Manchester University. The second year I did A-levels, because the first year they weren't good enough. So I'm very fortunate. These days you can't get in unless you're brilliant first time round. And I got in on the clearing scheme, which is just amazing because there are no clearing places for medicine later. But so I was extremely fortunate and got into Manchester.
Have you enjoyed that career all through your life?
As soon as I got into psychiatry, I did. As soon as I realised...
Because you have to be a doctor before you can go into psychiatry.
You become a doctor and then you do some medicine, general medicine. And then I worked with elderly people in medicine for a bit and did a bit of orthopaedics, which was hopeless. I wouldn't recommend you to have your legs set by me. And then I realised I really did want to be a psychiatrist. I'd done a little bit of it when I was a medical student and got fascinated by it. And the fact that quite a lot of medical students are frightened of mental health patients, don't like working with them and find it all a bit foreign. It's not really what they came to do. I took to it like a duck to water, really. I loved it straight away. I found I did find a rapport with patients. And so I did general psychiatry, and then I did older people's psychiatry. And when I trained in older people's psychiatry, and I'm sure it probably the influence of my grandmother developing dementia, when I trained in that, it was where people went when they didn't want to work very hard. You went to work in these long-stay hospitals, and there was these rows and rows of demented old folk in beds. Nothing was being done for them or their families, often 20 miles away from where the family lived. And it was scandalous, really. And if you went into working with those, somebody said to me, well, that at least you get plenty of time off. They play golf every Thursday afternoon. They don't do a great deal of work, you know, doctors who work in that business. So I realised that unless I became an academic and became respectable as an academic, I might have some difficulty being seen as a respectable doctor, even though I wanted to work in that field. So that was one of the reasons I became an academic and started to do some research.
You came here on a rather dingy day.
Well, it was late afternoon. I think it was sort of an autumn day where, you know, it was a rather blurry afternoon, and I saw it, and I still felt it was magical. But by the time I got John here back to see it, the light was falling and he could hardly see the outside.
That was a pretty quick decision. You got hold of your husband in no time at all, really.
Yeah, well, he was in Norwich. We were staying in Norwich. And so I called him. Of course, that would be on a telephone, no mobile phones. I called him and managed to get him at Queensway. And he was able to get down here. So he did, yes, he came back straight away.
He did a quick dash.
Yeah.
Now, the exterior is red brick, isn't it?
Yeah. They put the brick skim on in 1676. But over the years, it's been terribly patched. So you've got a bit of Victorian brick around various places. You've got a bit of 20th century brick that somebody had put in just before we arrived in the 60s. Most of the brick is done in old English bond, but then there's a bit of old Flemish bond on the back of the house. I mean, the people who put the brick skim on, they made it look all right at the front. But when it came round to doing the back, they weren't so fussy. I didn't know we had a double moat until the Moat Society came along and sort of said, could they come and survey the moat? Well, I never heard of the Moat Society. I don't think they exist any longer. And they said, oh, no, you've got a very large moat here, but you've also got a double moat, which means that the house would have been, on the island, would have been prestigious.
You walked into the house, which has a brick shell, but when you got in, you were a bit surprised.
Well, it was timber framed. And it obviously had black and white. It was a black and white house inside.
That's odd, isn't it?
It is odd, but it's not as odd as you might think, because so many houses, for example, round here, there's so much ancient houses that are timber framed inside that have had new Georgian fronts put on them. If you think about Bungay, Beccles, a lot of places have had Georgian facades. If you know Asylum Manor House, it looks like it's a Georgian house, but in fact it's actually a very ancient house inside.
It's just really a progress, isn't it? Progress. They've got to
what? People modernise.
Basically modernise.
Exactly. They want to modernise and add rooms on.
Yeah.
And want it to look like a bigger, splendid modern house. Yeah. So that's what they did.
What does the house consist of? How many rooms have you got?
Well, not all that many. We've got the main kitchen, living room, dining room on the end, old staircase up there. And then upstairs, there used to be 6 bedrooms. We changed that so there's 4 bedrooms with bathrooms. And then there's another floor on top of that, which was the servants' quarters, which we actually just cleared out and made sure that we had everything renter-killed, you know. There was another secondary staircase from the kitchen here that went up all the way up. In fact, part of the space is now used as another bathroom, but originally there would have been stairs straight from the kitchen up to the second floor. And that's where people who worked in the house, the maids and so on, would have slept up there.
Who built the house originally?
Almost certainly a couple called John and Marjorie Spalding, who in about between 1520, 1540, moved the house, decided to build a new house over on this side and abandoned the house on the island, presumably which was quite small.
How long did they live here?
Well, I can't remember the exact date. The Spalding family stayed here for 300 years. And the last one died in 1733, I think it was.
While you were delving into the history, you met a number of characters. A lot of characters have come out of it, haven't they?
Yes. Well, of course, you know, when you go into a house, you find lots of people have been here. I suppose my favourite character remains Sam Spalding, who was